The word police has a dirty, dirty connotation these days. But people want to stop their funding. They're corrupt. They're abusing their power. All these things. Well, I had an opportunity to talk to an ex-policeman, and he could expose or share honestly what it's really like. And are all policemen power hungry, or do they actually just care and want to help and then get frustrated in their inability to help? So for those of you that are big advocates for police officers, and also those that hate them, this would be a good moment to have a listen, and it will give you insights for your business as well. Like if you own a business and you're wanting to find a way to spend that lump sum of money and a meaningful, lasting way that still brings joy to your eyes because you've actually got a good plan. Well, he's also a financial planner. So if you hate the police, if you love the police, and if you want to make money with the money you have, this is for you. What was your first ever job? How did it all start?
Oh, right. Well, I worked right from the age of 12 working in wool stores because my old man was a wool broker. And so we didn't get paid pocket money. If we wanted money, we had to go out and work in the wool stores. So, that was a lot of good fun. Learned a lot of things from a lot of older guys who were there. And it certainly, without disrespecting the hard work that those people do, I figured out pretty quickly that I didn't want to work in a wool store for the rest of my life. So I then went out and we had two massive walnut trees on our property in Christchurch. And so I used to collect up walnuts and cycle those down to the markets in the morning and sell them during the walnut season. So that was another way of generating money. And it was my first lesson in diversification as well. It was when was it, 68, that the Waheny sunk, and half of my crop disappeared because it dropped one of the walnut trees. So I very quickly learned that you can't rely on one thing in life to get an outcome for you. But fortunately, we had a bit of land, so Mum and Dad gave me some dirt that I could grow some rhubarb in. So I had two cash crops.
My first job was a wool presser.
Oh yeah, well I've done wool pressing and done all of that stuff. But yeah, but look, not long after I left school, I guess you can say my first real job is I joined the police, and I was in there for 20 odd years.
What's it like behind the scenes? Because you know they're getting a bit of heat now. I don't think it's warranted. I mean, some people muck up like 1% in any employment, but. What is life actually like as a policeman? Is it fun? Is it stressful? Do they have to get drunk every Friday to cope with the, you know, the meaningless existence of their lives? Or what's it like?
It's extremely rewarding. It's extremely stressful, particularly street policing. And for me, I thought it was always a young person's game. I mean, I said when I joined, I couldn't see myself being a cop at 40. And funnily enough, I got out when I was 41. So that was quite prophetic. But yeah, look, it's a very rewarding job, but very stressful. You know, it's both physically stressful, mentally stressful. You get to face a whole lot of things that a lot of other people in life don't. But it's a wonderful job for teaching you some really good basics, which have helped me flow through into business. Number one is the importance of a team. Not trying to do everything on your own because you can't. The use of specialists, because again, you can't know everything. And so having a team of specialists around you to drive an outcome. And as most small to medium-sized business owners know, trying to do a whole lot with scarce resource, you never have enough resources to do what you really want to be able to do. So you've got to, you know, test and apply your scarce resources to try and drive an outcome. And those are all good, very life, you know, good life lessons that I found that I could carry across into business. So that took a lot of planning, which is really what I do now. You have to use that planning skill you get taught. And I guess the last lesson it teaches you is your ability to influence people and listen to people. Because policing, in a way, is not too different to what I do now in terms of helping people plan their lives financially. It's about listening to what their problems are in a different way and just applying a whole lot of different tools to different problems. You don't get quite the immediate feedback in this job, though, that you did in policing. You got fairly immediate feedback if you got things wrong in policing, because you found yourself sitting on your ass pretty quickly if you got it wrong. Or worse, whereas you don't tend to get sat on your ass quite so much in this current role.
Well, that's good, yeah, unless when the market's down or something. What's you're talking about stress. So what actually is it like? What's a moment that stands out for you when you were there that you're like, oh, this is dicey?
Look, many and varied, and you know, from sitting on the sides of buildings trying to talk people off them, having people firing guns at you, having people, you know, all sorts of things. But I guess those things teach you a lot about yourself, a lot about resilience, a lot about what's important in life. You know, ultimately, people are important in life. That's the real thing that it teaches you, is those who you love, those who rely on you, to make sure that you're there and you come home for those people.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. It's like, I can't imagine feeling in some way pursuing a job to protect and care for people. You know, some people wouldn't do it for that reason, but I imagine that's a lot of the reason. Well, actually, what is the reason people go into policing? What do you think, from when you spoke to them? It have varied. Some control freaks.
A small number of people, that will be it, that power and control thing. Most people want to do some good. Want to be able to help people in times of crisis. Whether that's the victim or the perpetrator, they're both going through some crisis at the time. But really, yeah, they want to make some sort of difference in their community, because they see that as a good thing to do. How can you make changes in people's lives? How can you perhaps right some wrongs? Eventually, you know, that can beat people down, because it can be very frustrating as well, because you realize again pretty quickly that you're only one piece of the puzzle. You're only one part of the answer. You know, yes, you can stop somebody from doing something, but how do you do that long term? Well, that takes a lot more than just physically stopping them, arresting them, or whatever. Or you can comfort somebody who's been through a particular crisis as a victim. But in terms of them getting better long term, that's not something that you can really influence as a police officer. That takes a whole lot of other professional input to be able to do that. So it's multifaceted response to making that change. That's probably one of the things you're ignorant of going in. I certainly was ignorant of going in. You think you can make a whole lot more change than what you actually can. And again, very, very good lessons for the rest of your life. Lessons for business, lessons for what I do now. That for most people, it's a multifaceted approach. You know, there's that cliche, you know, if you want to go fast, you know, go alone. But if you want to go far, then you've got to do it with other people. That applies both in my previous career in the policing, and it certainly applies now in business and in doing financial planning with people. It's a team sport. It's not an individual sport.
Just FYI for the people, I might time things wrong or interrupt. There's random moments where you just freeze for a whole period of time, and I'm just trying to time it. So we've pieced the puzzle. It's going fine, I think. So
yeah,
and we will move on from the police side of things. But If you could make a sweeping change and had the ability to influence all these professional practices, where do you think the service is failing people, or if it is run well, why is it run well? And how
you're talking here? You're talking here about financial services. If I could fix that,
nah, just the people that you're coming across a lot from in terms of crime, in terms of victims. And you're wanting to help and make a meaningful change, but you're limited in the scope as a policeman. But now imagine you're Emperor of New Zealand and you can just sweep across and change all the systems to reduce crime and to support people be better. What do you think you'd change?
I think a lot of stuff is driven by desperation and poverty. That's not to say that... it's only poor people that commit crime, because that's not right. It's only a very small percentage of people that create most of the crime. And the things that need to change for them, begin right back with parenting, upbringing, making the ability to make good decisions. And when people are in crisis, it's very hard to make good decisions. When you haven't had role models as to how to make good decisions, it's very hard for you to do that. Very hard for a kid of 8, 9, 10, 11, 15, 16, if they've never had a role model in terms of how to make good decisions. That's not an innate thing. That is very much a learned thing. So, yeah, a lot of that comes back to the work people try and do with parenting and dealing with poverty and things like that to help people make those good decisions. And let's face it, the stats are very much skewed towards you and me. We're males. There's that whole thing about our brains not being developed until we're 25, whereas female brains are fully developed a whole lot sooner than ours, which is why they don't feature very highly in the crime stats. Funnily enough, I look at that in my new role, and most women make far better investors than what young men do as well. They're far better at making good decisions around their money.
Yeah, I can't remember what study it was, but it was like women are less likely to invest, but more likely to get it right once they decide. So the other interesting thing I look at crime in a way in an antisocial aggressive behavior. And with women, a lot of the studies have been around the fact that they don't outwardly show physical aggression, but they would cause reputation damage. You know what I mean? So if you're physically less imposing, you're naturally going to have to try a cunning way to show some form of aggression. You don't have to comment on that. I thought that was interesting, because it's not always clear. You know, the old mate that punched Sally down, well, old mate that got in a fight is pretty clear. Sally that's quite cunning and painting a picture and, you know, so and destroying a person's reputation isn't as clear. But anyways, we're going on.
That might be something which is more now than certainly when I was around, because there wasn't social media really back in those days. So the ability to easily do that was quite different. But yeah, I don't want to get into a whole conversation about social media.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, okay, so you're 41, you realized, okay, policing has to end sometime. Well, what happened then? You went at Countdown, or what was your next step?
No. I left police on Friday, and I started where I still am on the Monday. I was ready for a change. I'd answered an ad back in those days. It was in the newspaper, so that shows you how long ago that was. And it was the ad from a guy who is still my business partner, Steve Baker. And about, you know, do you want to make some changes? Are you sick of working for the man? Do you want to be in charge of your own destiny? And, you know, having grown up in a family, business owners, self-employed, I'd had investment property, had shares, you know, so I was used to investing. I wasn't scared of being self-employed, albeit at that stage I'd worked for about 20 years for a for a salary, but I'd had very good role model in terms of my parents, in terms of being self-employed, so that didn't scare me to make that change. It was a big change going from a six-figure salary to a zero-figure income, but you sink or you swim. And I was fairly determined that I was going to make it work. So yeah, it came from I was ready for a change. And again, that old cliche, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I was ready. Why did I turn to Situations Vacant in the newspaper at the particular day that I did? And why did I see that particular ad? Who knows, but I did. And 26 years later, I'm still here, and I now own the business. Well, not all of the business, but I'm a part owner in a business.
That's wild. What was your day? So you get there, so you got no income now, and then you're like, okay, here's a phone. Like, what did you do? What was your first strategy?
Well, the very good thing about joining this particular business is it's very systems driven. Policing is very systems driven. You know, you follow a system, you follow a process, you are more likely to get a result. It's the same in business if you follow a system and a process. So it was one of the things that, as I was going through the recruitment process, I guess for want of a better word, that attracted me to this business, because I was coming from one systems driven business in a way to another systems driven business. I liked their system and their process. And they told me that if I followed this system and this process, and if I did this education and invested in this education, and I trusted them, which I did and I still do, then this is the result. And very much I followed their system, I followed their process, I went back to university. I learned about a whole lot of other tools to use in a different industry. I was told I was no longer allowed to use my baton and my handcuffs in this new industry. So I had to learn about a whole different tool set and daily training, which we still do in here. Daily training for a minimum of 2 years, 8:30 to 9:30, Monday to Friday. So good in-house training, good academic training back at university, and then see the people.
Yeah, obviously, you know, there's IP and people get, you know, protective about that, but usually the old model with financial planners and financial advisors, you partner with someone that knows all your clients and give them value until they trust you enough to refer. Or you go cold, or you partner with people that are in the area that your clients are, you know, for sponsoring and things like that. Or, yeah, what was your first attempt? Well, you followed a system, they already had it, or you didn't get a client for the first year, or what was your...
No, well, very much part of any business, and this runs across all businesses, is how do you find the right clients? You know, whether you've got a clothing store in the high street, whether you're a mechanic in the suburbs, or whether you're running a financial planning business, is how do you get in front of more of the right kind of people? So part of that, you know, a big part in financial services is about getting referred to people who you believe that you can help. So in our business, they taught us how to get referrals from the people who we were meeting. How to be credible in front of those people, how to be reliable in front of those people, and how to develop and I use the word carefully, but the right amount of intimacy with those people. So do you really know them, and do you really know, and can you identify what their key financial issues are and how those are impacting on their lives? So if you can learn how to have that credibility and reliability, and you develop that intimacy with your clients, then they refer you on to other people. I guess the last piece of that puzzle is, it's more than authenticity, it's self-orientation. I guess in all things in life, if people think that you are self-orientated, in other words, it's what's important for you that you're getting out of this relationship, then you don't get those referrals. But if people genuinely believe that what you're trying to do is to better their situation, that the orientation is towards them, then that's a win-win. It's, you get what's called reciprocity. You know, if you're giving and people believe that having dealt with you, that they are better off in their particular lives, then they're much more likely to refer you to other people. And that is a process as you build it up. You're not going to get on with everybody who you get in front of. Doesn't matter what industry you're in, but you'll eventually find people who you relate to. It's like your group of friends. It's like the people at the football club or the bridge club or the book club or, you know, whatever networks you're part of. You eventually find like-minded people who believe that what you're trying to do is going to, or help them with, is going to better their lives. So they're more likely to introduce you to their friends because they have a belief in what it is that you're doing for them.
Yeah, I'm a believer that intent has a smell. And even kids know, you know, like you don't have to be well-defined and, you know, have high EQ to recognize when someone seems like they don't have your best interest at heart. Do you think of ways to make the actual referral easier? So one guy I never met, and I always refer people to him because he made a course that's free and you don't have to put your email in. And it's a low level, so you're not losing status by referring to them because you know the outcome that they'll receive. Do you think about that, how to present it in a way where the referral is easier to come by or is better?
Well, yeah, one thing that we're never afraid in this business is to ask. You know, I've found for most things in life, if you ask people for what it is that you want, you're more likely to get it than if you just sit back and you leave them guessing as to what it is that you want. So we do ask people who we have worked with and who we believe that we've added value to, who else they know that they think might get benefit from what it is that we do. And sometimes they, you know, we get a referral and other times we don't. Sometimes we don't ask and out of the blue, and look, it happens after you've been in the industry for a while, out of the blue, you'll get a phone call from somebody, you'll get an email from somebody who is just introducing. But the first thing is ask people for what it is that you want. And so part of our business process is to go, hey, Ryan, now that we've done this business, have you got value from it? And is there anybody else who you know that we don't know that you think might get value from the sort of work that we've done for you? So, you know, we're talking about somebody who looks like you. Do you know somebody else? And if they do, then they're going to refer those people to you. If they don't, they won't. And some people, it's just not what they do. And they say that very upfront. Look, it's not what I do. I don't refer people, Warwick. And that's okay. That just means it's not what they do.
My computer just broke. Every time. The whole time I was just winging it. We're not speaking. But, yeah, so referrals is what you're saying. Do you think of the point of time with referrals, the time of greatest value to ask? And then what is that moment within a financial planning context to be like, hey, this is when you ask for the referral?
Absolutely. You know, we're great proponents that first I must deliver value before I can expect to get something back for that. That's right from I've got to deliver some value before I expect to get paid a fee. I've got to deliver some value and make some change in your life before I would expect that you're going to refer me to somebody. So there's both referrals that are direct from the clients themselves, And then there's referrals from, you remember earlier on, I said that, you know, getting people ahead financially and helping them make smart decisions is actually a team sport, because people's situations are often quite complex. And the same as back in my policing life, we couldn't solve everything. Financial planners can't solve everything to do with people's financial lives either, because there can be legal constraints or legal considerations that need to get taken into account around ownership or relationship property or trust structures. So that's going to take a legal professional, a lawyer, to be involved in getting those structures right for people. There can be complex tax situations that are involved in getting an outcome for people. And so therefore you need their accountants involved. And again, when you're working with those other professionals, when they see what you are doing for perhaps their client or a client that you've introduced to them, that is a, you know, another good source of getting clients, again, and us referring our clients to those people. So you'll find that most financial planners are very good connectors. They will have 3, 4, 5 different accountants who they would refer to. They'll have 3, 4, 5 different lawyers who they would refer to, either because of personality type, they think they're going to get on better with a particular client. It might be ethnicity. It might be the particular speciality that they have. It might be location. There can be a whole range of things as to why you're going to refer to one. You know, it's a bit like a doctor. A doctor is not going to refer you if you need hip surgery. They're not going to refer you to an ophthalmist. You know, they're going to look for the right fit. So client referrals is one way that you get to build your business. Having those good relationships and quality relationships with other professionals that work across that area as well is the other way, really, that I've built my business. And I think you find that most successful financial planners as well will have that. They'll be very good connectors to those other professionals who are involved in people's financial lives.
It just makes sense. It's like, so pretty much all I do now is just make calls and make videos. And I was calling a lot of financial advisors, and some of them were like, oh, I don't need any more clients, Ryan. And I'm like, oh, okay, what do you need? They're like, oh, well, I'm trying to sell my business. I'm like, well, I'm calling all of you all over the country. So he wants to sell his business. He's looking to buy it. Do you want me to introduce you guys? He's like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, why not? And it just makes sense. It's like, there's this person that has these problems. So financial planning is obvious. You know, you got people that want trust, enduring powers of attorney, wills. That's a synergy. Trying to earn the trust of a lawyer that's, you know, usually quite conservative in their recommendations because of the consequences of that. And then accountants. What's the perfect web of a financial life, do you think? Who's the partners that you should accumulate throughout your life to be successful?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, for most of my clients who are, you know, reasonably affluent, if they've come out of business or if they've worked for a big corporate, they will know that they have had other people around them in that corporate who have been influential in terms of being able to drive an outcome for the corporate, or if they've been in business. And so they will be often their accountant around their tax and their structural advice and making sure they're paying the right amount of tax but not leaving a tip for the IRD. And it'll be that lawyer, whether that's with employment agreements or leases or buy-sell agreements or shareholder agreements or getting the right trust or making sure the will is in place. I would say those are the two key ones that are there. But it can be having the right real estate agent if they've got a lot of money tied up in property. Having somebody who you can trust and advise on there can be very important if that's how they've grown their wealth. It might be the business broker if they're in the process of acquiring other businesses because that's the way that they have grown their business, or they want to exit their business, having a very good business broker around. So I don't think it necessarily has to be that broad, but just knowing that you can go out and ask. I've had a couple of clients recently who have got forestry on their properties, which are all around carbon credits. Not something at all that I have any expertise in at all. But it only took me two phone calls to find one of the top people in New Zealand who could advise them on that. One person was selling their particular property, and another one was buying a property, not the same one, but another one who wanted some input in prior to structuring the deal for the purchase of that property. So by building those relationships and not being scared to get on the phone and just saying, you know, I don't know everything, but I will find out for you, which often can be, I find, Ryan, an issue for that Kiwi number eight mentality that we get with people, particularly smaller business owners, that they have got there because of just the hard work and graft that they have put in. And to start to let somebody else come in and around that when, you know, look, they could have had a bad experience with an insurance advisor or a real estate agent or a lawyer or an accountant or a financial planner or whatever. They can think that, you know, that what's got them there is what's going to get them there. And so being able to break that down and say, you know, we don't know everything, and what necessarily has got you there is not what's going to get you there. That can be pretty important for them to get that right expert, because, hey, look, we all make mistakes. I will make mistakes tomorrow. I'll make them the next day. It's actually how as an animal we learn. We just hope that they won't be fatal. And I find that I make less mistakes the more people I ask, the more people identify stuff who know things that I don't know, the less mistakes I make.
Yeah, it's much easier to learn from other people's mistakes. I think it's quite interesting because I don't know how many business owners I've spoken to a lot now. But it's interesting watching the limitations of their business and related to the limitations of their mindset. And how I have that too, in my own limit. But one would be like a level of arrogance around not willing to learn or develop, or the inability to relinquish control, to trust someone because you were taught that you should ignore everyone else, that, you know, you start a business, let's say. Your family's like, oh, don't do that. Get a job. You're not going to make it. Blah, blah, blah. And they just push through. So they get reinforced for their, you know, innovation and being separate from others. And then the moment they get to a size enough where they have to decentralize and trust in others, then they're confronted with, oh, I got to unlearn that. So what's how do you help them see the light? Or what was your turning point?
Yeah, look, that's that would really be the crux of planning, is that trust and control, particularly when you're working with business owners who have grown a very successful business. Their financial success has come from that hard graft, that entrepreneurial spirit, that doing it their way, has grown this fantastically successful business. I often say to business owners, you know, they treat it like it's the only child that it listens to them, because he or she has probably got kids at home that certainly don't listen to them, but they sort of feel like their business is the child that does listen to them because it gets done their way. But then as they transition out of that and they end up with a bag of money to a business owner who's been successful is a very, very scary thing, because they've never seen their business as a bag of money until they come to transition out. And so how do you do that? Yeah, that's a lot of hand-holding. And that can be 6, 9, 12, 18 months of getting people used to seeing their wealth in a different way. That their business started off being a good idea, a handshake with a mate in a pub or with their partner lying in bed one night talking about, you know, how do we not work for somebody else? How do we grow this? And suddenly they're 55, 60, 65, 70, and they've grown this wonderful thing, and now that's translated into a bag of money, and they've never seen it like that, and it's got a lot of zeros on the end of it. So they suddenly realize that the science of what's accumulated wealth for them is not going to be the science of how they're going to retain that wealth or retain that wealth or pass that wealth on to next generation. That's not what they're used to. And that's really the sort of work that I do with people. And if you take it back to what I was saying earlier, number one, you've got to say, are you somebody credible? Do they believe that you are somebody credible that can help them with that? And if they don't, then they're not going to deal with you. And are you reliable? Are you a business, you know, I'm a business owner, they're a business owner. Sometimes that helps you with that credibility. You know, I've got 30 people here in the business. I'm one of six shareholders. But I feel their pain of being in business. I know what that's like. And that helps with the intimacy of, you know, I face the same struggles that they do. I can understand those things that they are facing. So that can take time with, just take time with them and realize that, yes, they've got to let go some control. Or, of course, the alternatives is not to let go the control and retain an interest in the business. And that can be a very valid thing to do, is if you can trust the people who are going to be there and stay running your business, keep on running your business. You were talking earlier on about you connecting one financial planner who wants to sell with another financial planner that wants to stay. We have a vision that we'll never sell our business, that we'll never sell out, that we will just keep getting paid out of our business, because the people who have taken over looking after our business are good enough to keep on driving a dividend for us. That's just a different business model. But most business owners that, you know, that you've alluded to before will cash out at some stage or cash out a significant part. And that can be scary times for them. As scary as what it is for somebody who's been on a six-figure income, working in a corporate, working in government, who's accumulated a whole lot of wealth, be that in property or their KiwiSaver or managed funds, to go from that accumulation mindset to a de-accumulation mindset. A mindset, well, if I muck up today or tomorrow, it doesn't matter because I've got another paycheck coming, to that paycheck has stopped and now I've got a bag of money. So that does take a team. That won't just be on my shoulders or another financial planner's shoulders. We will not have all the answers, having those right structures for them. How are they going to preserve that wealth? How are they going to enhance that wealth? How are they going to make sure that they pay the right amount of tax, they don't underpay it so they get in the crack with the IRD, but they're not paying too much, so therefore they're not being able to enhance their particular wealth. How are they going to, you know, a lot of clients then end up with a wonderful money problem. They go through their life thinking they've got one money problem, which is they don't have enough, and suddenly they've cashed out and they realize they've got a different money problem. They've now probably got too much. And having too much money, a lot of people think, oh, what a wonderful problem to have. And in a way, yes, it's far better than not having enough, but it does bring other problems with it. What are you going to do in terms of helping your kids? And are you going to help your kids equally? And if you're going to help your kids with money, particularly if they're my generation, we say, well, how am I going to do that without spoiling the younger generation? Because there's a certain satisfaction from having worked hard in anything and achieved a goal, whether you're in sports. You know, I mean, people in sports are probably the best example. It doesn't matter what mum or dad do for them. Mum and dad can have a little bit of influence, but ultimately it's the young man or the young woman's personal exertion that's got them there. And that satisfaction that you see from your kids getting that perhaps in the sporting arena, you know that now if you do that in the financial arena, you just hand them a bag of money, that they're not actually going to get a lot of that personal satisfaction that comes from hard work and discovering things for themselves. But at the same time, you do want to help them. You do, you know, because if you've got too much money, why would you wait until you died at 90 or 95 and your kids are now 65 or 70 and had to carry a mortgage all that time and had to put braces on the kids' teeth and help them out, you know, the grandkids with their education? Why wouldn't you help them out now? But that's a worry for them. How do they strike that balance between assisting them without spoiling them? You know, so that's a
real problem.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it's like you think, oh, you're cutting out. Can you hear me again?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
All right, good. Yeah, I was just saying, like, you think no matter who you are, rich, poor, you know, middle class, you're going to face adversity. And the better you can prepare your children for facing the adversity, the better their lives are. It's not proportionate to how much money they have. And if they've got a whole lot of money and they didn't have to develop the traits to be worthy of that money, then really you're just giving them a burden, you know, a free handout that hasn't developed the fortitude to navigate life. So how do you give and not spoil them? What's your last remark as we've almost finished?
Yeah, well, I guess part of that is, you know, if you're somebody who's used to making bad decisions and then you get a whole lot of money, you're still going to make bad decisions. How do you instill that in your kids? How do you instill, yeah, and look, it's kind of financial planning 101 is, if you can, spend less than you earn. You know, I know it sounds simple, but that's about having that mindset that you are your most valuable quantity, so keep some of your money for you. Don't give it to other. Spending is giving your money to other people. If you save, it's saying, I'm the most valuable person, I'm going to leave some in my pocket. It's having that mindset first. And then once you've got that mindset, then it's, how do I now make that money grow so I can replace people at work? Most of us generate money by swapping hours for dollars. That's people at work. But how can I take some of that money and make money work for me? It sounds very simple. And to a degree it is, if you develop just that good habit. Most people don't develop that good habit. They spend their life spending everything they earn, in fact, spending more than they earn. So therefore, when they stop earning, it is a very fearful time because they haven't put away enough. And so then for, you know, you're either going to be reliant on yourself at the end of the day, or you're going to be reliant on others financially. And the only way to be reliant on yourself is not spending everything that you've earned throughout your working life. It's about putting money away, locking that up into a business or into property or into a managed fund or into KiwiSaver or into shares or whatever you're going to lock it up into. So therefore, you've got something left to rely on at the end rather than having your hand out because you've spent everything. So therefore, you're reliant on your family, you're reliant on government, you're reliant on other agencies. Now, look, there are some people, of course, who never have that opportunity. And so I'm not blind to the fact that there are a lot of people who are, you know, so-called on a living wage that will never get that opportunity to do it. But what I know is that there is a large number of people, 80% of people are not like that, but less than 5% of that 80% actually put money away on a regular basis to make sure that they can be self-reliant. Most of them just spend everything they earn.
Yeah, it's crazy. But anyways, you've done a whole podcast with 10,000 different glitches, so thanks for coming on.
That's all right. I'll look forward to how you de-glitch it for me.
Yeah, me too.